24th, celebrate the Cumbia Diaspora at California Plaza in downtown LA with performances by Chucho Ponce y Los Daddies, Jason Landero, and DJ Chihuahua, presented by Discos Rolas. For more information, please visit grandperformances.org and kpfk.org.
You are listening to KPFK 90.7 FM, Los Angeles.
Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right.
Get up, stand up. Well, good afternoon, my friends. Good afternoon, friends and listeners. This is Jim Lafferty, along with my co-host Maria Hall, welcoming you to this week's edition of the Lawyers Guild Show. I'm thrilled to be back with you. I was off for a number of months. Maria, of course, did a super job while I was gone. But it'll be a little less work for you now, Maria, right?
Well, I hope so. But, you know, the news out there, it keeps us busy.
I know it does. Well, you sure as heck would be busy. Really, just a fabulous job all summer. Let our listeners know what's in store for them today.
Yes, well, thanks, Jim. On today's show, we'll be exploring the local and global efforts to silence critics of Israel's war on Palestinians, even as violence in the Middle East escalates. First, we'll be joined by Esty Chandler, chair of Jewish Voice for Peace Action, about holding the line for peace while our country pledges more military support for Israel, not only for its defense, but also for offense. Then, in our second segment, we'll speak with Elizabeth Howell-Egan, a third-year law student at USC, about whether college students around the country are ready to pick up last spring's pro-Palestinian protests, where they left off, and how university officials might respond.
Absolutely. Well, I guess I'm up first then because I know Esty, a longtime friend and one of the wonderful activists around this and so many other issues, is our first guest. All of the public's, of course, and the press's attention, but not all of it, I shouldn't say, but a great deal of it is now focused, of course, on the presidential campaign. And that has resulted in the U.S. movement against the what's going on in, with Israel and Palestine, the U.S. war there, the Israeli war there, and less visible. It gets attention in the press, but not as much as it was getting, of course. And not because all such protests have stopped. Indeed, just yesterday morning, dozens of pro-Palestinian protesters, most of them Jewish, caused the southbound 405 freeway right here in L.A. to be closed for an hour while the police removed and arrested those in the protest who were blocking traffic. And certainly there's been no diminution in the ongoing genocidal military assault itself on the people of Gaza, where the official death toll has now reached 40,000. With the unofficial toll being many, many times higher. And there's also less attention being paid to what anti-Palestinian state legislatures in California have been doing on behalf of their effort to squash pro-Palestinian protests, pro-Palestinian speech, and what have you. So then today on the Lawyers Guild Show, on behalf of renewing and putting more focus again on the humanitarian disaster unfolding in Palestine, the protest movement against it, and the government's effort to censor and halt the work of that protest movement, we are pleased, as I say, to welcome back to our show Ms. Esty Chandler. Now, Esty Chandler is, I say, a longtime peace and social justice activist and leader. She is currently board chair of a Jewish Voice for Peace Action. And so a warm welcome, Esty Chandler, back to the Lawyers Guild Show.
Thank you so much, Jim. It's always great to be with you and Maria.
Absolutely. Now, Esty, as I just said in introducing the topic, given the understandable, all-consuming public and press coverage of the presidential election campaigning going on, there has been less attention being paid to what is happening in Gaza and throughout Palestine. But the situation is, in fact, growing worse and worse and more dire every single day, does it not? There is now a growing fear, if you will, of it becoming a regional-wide war. Hell, the Biden administration has just sent another $3.5 billion in military aid to Israel, and now they're lining up to send another $22 billion. One after another of these Israelis have declared safe evacuation zones have proved to be quite the opposite, and they are being attacked by Israel as Palestinians have tried to move into those supposedly safe zones, resulting in more deaths every day of Palestinians, fewer places for them to live or hide, less medical care, more hunger, all about that. So talk to us a bit about that, would you, Esty? Bring us up to date, those folks perhaps who have not been paying as close attention to this as they should.
I think you're right, Jim. I think Israel's massive military assault, which every respected human rights organization in the world has correctly identified as a genocide, which, as you know, has a legal definition, continues to worsen, as do the crimes that we are reading and hearing reports about, which the Israeli military and government are committing. So while the mainstream media is fixated on the presidential election, and it's true that traditionally, come Labor Day, the public tends to start focusing on the November elections as well. At the same time, I think we're seeing the Palestinian Liberation Movement, which remains focused on stopping the ongoing genocide, now in its 10th month, continue to show up where media is, which includes in Washington, D.C., when congressional leaders disgracefully gave a national stage to a war criminal, Prime Minister Netanyahu. We're seeing them show up at rallies on the presidential campaign trail. And also, as you noted in your opening, creating organic headlines by stopping business as usual, by halting morning traffic on the busiest freeway in the country.
You know, I wonder, permit me, Maria, before I know you want to ask some questions now, too. But let me just say one thing that's on my mind, and I just feel compelled to say it. I'd be happy to get Esty's reaction, or for that matter, yours too, Maria, of course. You know, any number of my friends, this was true when I was over in Europe this summer, it's true back home, when this subject comes up, say to me, you know, Jim, I just can't pay the same kind of attention to it that I used to. I can't bear watching those videos, you know, of children and the terrible condition they're in, the burns, the amputations. My God, what has happened? I just can't do it to myself. I try to read about it, but I just can't watch it. And I understand that. We all have to do what we have to do to keep sane. But it bothers me. It troubles me because I think we have to, we just have to bear witness. And when we turn away from the images, which are so much stronger than the words, we are not bearing full witness to a historic genocide that continues with, frankly, no real end in sight. Is that asking too much of people? Am I being too judgmental when I say I wish the hell people would keep watching? And it makes me cry. It makes me angry. But I refuse to turn away. Am I just being nuts or what? What do you think, Esty, Maria?
Well, I'll be honest with you, Jim. I am struggling myself. I am seeing things that I cannot unsee. I am kept up at night. I am often unable to eat. And so I think it's a tough call. I think that we have, as you say, we must continue to bear witness. I am choosing from time to time when I need to look away from the video
of course.
To focus on the work at hand, to focus on helping organize, because that's important. I think that we have to be understanding of people who are, you know, expressing having a hard time watching the images. But I think the thing to say is, if you can't watch the images, then what are you doing? Are you calling your congressional representatives? Are you calling the White House? Are you donating if you can? Are you helping organize in your community? Are you talking to your friends? There are things people can do, and we all, as you say, must bear witness and must be on the side of action towards ending this genocide, the most photographed and documented genocide in history.
Well put, my friend. Yeah, well put. Well, I turn it over to you, Maria.
Well, let's look towards what possibly could happen, which would be a ceasefire, although it seems like we're hearing one, you know, on the one hand, we hear, oh, there maybe there's talks, you know, promoting a ceasefire. But then on the other hand, we see reports from the New York Times yesterday that they've seen secret Israeli documents showing that despite what Prime Minister Netanyahu says in public, he's actually coming up with new demands that he'll put forth during the next round of ceasefire talks, which might derail it. Derail them, the talks, before they even begin. What can you tell us about this in general, and what about the likelihood of a ceasefire coming about anytime soon?
Well, Maria, that New York Times story did report that Netanyahu had placed new conditions to Israel's demands for an agreement, and I believe that his own negotiators characterized the demands as creating extra obstacles to making a deal. But let's be clear, nothing that he has said or done in the past 10 months has convinced anyone that he actually wants a ceasefire. Not even growing public pressure in Israel to bring home the remaining hostages. And his legal situation certainly points to it being in his personal interest to continue this genocidal assault on Palestinians for as long as possible so his trials don't continue. And likely until after the November elections, in hopes that there will be another Trump administration who he openly campaigned for in 2020. So having said that, I think it's also important to say that President Biden is likewise not taking actions that would convince anyone that he wants a ceasefire. But in his case, it is even more baffling because he's not under indictment like Netanyahu. And I don't see how an immediate and permanent ceasefire that includes the release of hostages and prisoners and, Palestinian detainees, and also importantly refunds UNRWA, the UN Relief and Works Agency, isn't in the best interest of this country and Biden's political party, you know, looking at the elections ahead.
Yes. But no, I didn't mean to cut you off. Absolutely right. One of the things that has concerned me for some time now is the question of the accuracy of reports we're getting in the even the responsible press as to what the death total is in Palestine as a result of what Israel's doing with our weapons and all the rest. Let's take a look at it. The figure one finds in the press all the time is now, well, that the total is at 40,000, the 40,000 dead mark. But there is there not very good reason to acknowledge that it is certainly much, much higher. For example, the worldwide and highly prestigious, respected medical journal in England, The Lancet, has conducted an exhaustive study and concluded that a much more realistic and accurate figure of those killed so far is, wait for it, 186,000 Palestinian men, women, and children. In short, what they've shown is that when you include in that statistic of how many have died, those who indirectly died, you know, from the results of the munitions dropped on the Palestinians, maybe they didn't die when the bomb hit them on the head, but they died some days later from it, you reach, at the very least, and the count continues, a total of 186,000 killed so far, and because of what's still under the rubble, of course, many, many, perhaps thousands more. But anyway, SD, what are your thoughts on this, and then why the movement, as well as the press, you never seem to hear that figure much. It's always that 40,000 dead figure and probably many more.
That's right. I think, Jim, if we look at the video images from Gaza that we were talking about and we compare them to the timeline of the number of reported deaths, they simply don't track, especially following the destruction of the majority of Gaza's hospitals. So right now, it seems like neither the Gaza Health Ministry nor the aid agencies post the dismantling of the UN Relief and Works Agency actually have the capacity to produce actual numbers, largely because their reporting system is part of their medical system, which has been largely obliterated along with the hospitals in Gaza. So the report from The Lancet even notes that armed conflicts have indirect health impacts beyond people being killed as a direct result, as you say, of bullets, bombs, and other direct violence. For instance, those still trapped under the rubble are not being counted. Those who are succumbing to dehydration, starvation, lack of medical care for common illnesses, lack of medication for chronic illnesses, people experiencing heart attacks, strokes, etc., as happens in life, none of those are being counted. And because the Lancet report is science-based, they actually go on to explain that in recent conflicts, indirect deaths like those from the kinds of causes that I just named range from 3 to 15 times the number of direct deaths.
That's
so,
right.
Yes, that's exactly the point you were trying to make. And so apply a conservative estimate of 4 indirect deaths per 1 death to the over 37,000 deaths that had been reported at the time of the Lancet report. Make the plausible estimate, bring that up, as you say, to well over 186,000.
Mm-hmm.
Which also, very sadly means that even if the conflict ends immediately, there will continue to be many indirect deaths in the coming months and years from causes like reproductive, communicable diseases, non-communicable diseases, as a result of this genocidal campaign on the people of Gaza.
Well, S.D. Chandler, so far we've been seeing reports of pro-Palestinian activists confronting mainly the Democratic nominees, Kamala Harris and Tim Walz, at their rallies. But we haven't heard much, if anything, about such confrontations at the Trump-Vance rallies. And while similarly, there wasn't much coverage of protests at the Republican Party convention, we have heard we should be expecting a strong presence of protesters on a variety of issues, not just this one, at the upcoming Democratic Party convention. What are your thoughts on all this? And what also is happening with the Israeli lobbying efforts to censor pretty much anything that they paint with the brush of being anti-Semitic?
Well, the scenario you lay out, Maria, it actually makes sense to me, because this movement is a progressive movement. So because the majority of the voters in the movement are not Republican voters, we have more leverage with the Democratic Party and their candidates, and especially in the swing states, as we saw with the uncommitted movement in the primaries, there are a lot of votes that the Democratic Party needs in order to win elections in November within the Movement for Palestinian Rights, or who are continuing to work to end a genocide. I think the other factor is that the Democratic candidate, Kamala Harris, is the sitting vice president. So she holds both sway and responsibility for policy in the eyes of activists who are voters, volunteers, and donors in political campaigns up and down the ballot. So I don't think we should be surprised to see more focus and demonstrations happening as we expect at the DNC than we did at the RNC.
Well, speaking of that convention, and the fact this is, again, a presidential election year, historians will tell you, hell, I'm old enough and experienced enough to tell you, that mass movements in the streets on major issues generally become smaller during presidential elections, as more and more work is put into electing candidates that the movement thinks has a better position and might do the right thing, no matter how often we are disappointed by that. Also, campus protest, of course, decreases when colleges, universities, high schools are not in full session, as is true in the summer months. There are students there, but not what it is the rest of the year. So what would you say is the state, or so therefore we might, you know, just reading the paper, they get the impression, well, the movement is lost a lot of its fervor, and it's not as big or something. But what would you say, therefore, is the state of strength of the pro-Palestinian movement today, and do you think it will be demonstrating itself as being stronger than it is today when fall comes with the return of more students to campuses?
Well, you know, the movement was very, very, was built up a lot by Students for Justice in Palestine over the last decades. And as Macklemore famously sings, if the West was pretending that you didn't exist, you'd want the world to stand up. And the students finally did. I think recent events we've discussed makes it clear that the movement isn't slowing down and it is remaining strategic. I think that when school comes back, although it sounds like your next guest will have more information even than I do, but I do believe that when school comes back in the fall, the students will be back at it. I don't think they are going to stop bearing witness or turn away. And I believe that the movement will continue to use all opportunities presented to it by outrageous legislation being presented on local, state, and national levels, and by all of the political campaign events that are going to be becoming more and more apparent and, you know, plentiful around the country as we get closer to November. And those have built-in media attending them and would give wide exposure to the movement, which, by the way, the overwhelming majority of Americans supports. The overwhelming majority of Americans supports a permanent and immediate and permanent ceasefire. And as we saw in the news this week, Starbucks has just replaced their CEO, citing, among other factors, their sales slumping due to a consumer boycott over their support of Israel. So that is the BDS, Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions movement growing globally. So I think that the movement is strong and determined to see justice prevail.
Well, if you're just tuning in, this is the Lawyers Guild Show on KPFK 90.7 FM. I'm Maria Hall here with my co-host Jim Lafferty, who's finally back from his sabbatical. And we're speaking with Chair of JVP Action, Esty Chandler. And just a 20-second reminder that it's KPFK's Summer Fun Drive. So if you haven't given yet, please do so now. I'm about to on the website. By tuning into KPFK, you're casting a vote for freedom of speech and freedom of the press, which is becoming increasingly at risk. So you can jump on at kpfk.org, and we're not going to dwell on it. We're just going to trust you to do it. So next question, Esty. Please share your thoughts about the possibility of a ceasefire, which, as you mentioned, so many Americans really want. Is there any chance of one being negotiated anytime soon?
I mean, you know, there's always a chance, but as I laid out, it doesn't seem like the American government or the Israeli government actually wants a ceasefire. Why would we be sending over, you know, $3.5 billion worth of weapons if we wanted a ceasefire, right? I mean, this is probably the most dangerous moment since last October, following a series of high-level political assassinations that Israel has either taken responsibility for or is widely assumed to be responsible for. So it makes no sense whatsoever for the Biden administration and the vice president to be talking about working day and night on a ceasefire agreement while they continue to send billions of dollars of bombs and military weaponry to the region. Actions matter, not words. If this administration actually wants a ceasefire to happen, they need to immediately enact a weapons embargo on Israel and use their leverage to demand that Israel adhere to international and U.S. laws and policies. I believe that it was just following the announcement of the $3.5 billion package that an American precision missile was used to hit a Gaza City school compound that was last weekend, where approximately 350 families had been sheltering. The reports are that about 100 people were killed, including many women and children, and both the upper floor that was housing families and the lower floor that was being used as a mosque were hit while people were praying their dawn prayers. And, what makes it infuriating is that once again, Israeli officials are claiming that militants were among the dead, but they have a pattern now, and the media has seen no evidence of that, and Israeli authorities have once again provided no evidence to prove that claim, and yet just yesterday, Reuters reported that the U.S. government has approved another sale of $20 billion in fighter jets and military equipment for Israel.
Yep. Yeah, Esty, we are getting short on time, although, Maria, with your permission, I think we can run over a couple of minutes here on this. But, Esty, you have no crystal ball. I understand that, and nobody does when it comes to this. In one sense, this has been going on for, 75 years. But this particular war, this bloodiest period, perhaps, since the initial period of what has happened to the Palestinian people, what continues to happen, all the evidence that Netanyahu doesn't seem to want to see the war end and so forth, what do you see in broad strokes is likely to happen? Do you see the war ending quickly through ceasefire or some other means, or do you think it's being seen as being protracted even longer? Are the people of Israel not getting sick and tired of Netanyahu doing nothing really about the hostages, but simply continue with the war and so forth? Well, give us your non-crystal ball, but nevertheless thoughts on what we might expect in the period ahead.
I mean, like I said, I don't see either the Israeli government nor the U.S. government really showing any signs of ending this war. And, Netanyahu has every reason not to try to end it and to, hope to get an outcome in November that puts Trump back in the White House. I mean, it's a horrible thing to say, but I just don't see any evidence that these people want to see the war come to an end.
And the other thing I might say by way of an optimistic note is that I can tell you, and people who are my age will remember, especially those of us who were in the movement, that there at a period of time when the majority of Americans had turned against the war in Vietnam, Indeed, it was hard to see an end in sight on the field, but not simply because of what happened on the battlefield, but also what happened. There's a certain tipping point, the way they speak about a tipping point with global warming, where there's a certain tipping point with how long people will tolerate a war they do not support. It may not be that we have a draft now and our young men are dying there, but we're very much involved in it. Our tax dollars are going to commit horrific crimes. So I'm only saying that if we keep hopeful, if we keep active, if we build our movement even more, and I think it will build more, given the horrific situation on the ground in Gaza, I think the U.S. government may be surprised, and Netanyahu may be surprised, as to how long the U.S. can really continue to do what it's doing. It thought it could continue to supply the South Vietnamese with weapons endlessly, and it learned they couldn't do that either. Well, let's take a brief station ID break, and then if you could stay with us for maybe one or two more quick questions, Esty, let's do that.
Sure thing.
Hi, this is Lila Downs. You're listening to KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles, 98.7 FM Santa Barbara, globally on kpfk.org.
Si porque te quiero, quieres llorona que yo.
And you are indeed, my friends, listening to the music that introduces you to the Lawyers Guild Show. We're halfway or more through the show now. This is Jim Lafferty along with Maria Hall talking to our current guest, S.D. Chandler, who is board chair of Jewish Voice for Peace Action. And we've been talking, of course, about this horrific situation, the genocidal humanitarian crisis going on in Gaza. Let me do this in the interest of time. Just two very quick questions, S.D., then we'll let you go. Does the fact that there's been news about how the head of leaders of Hamas and of Fatah have now pledged to form a united Palestinian government, does that give you any reason for confidence? And lastly, where would you direct our listeners to go to read some good, honest reporting on what is going on in Gaza that they might not get in their local newspaper?
Well, Jim, I have every reason to believe that the Palestinian leaders want to see, what we want to see. They believe, like we do, that Palestinians, like all people, should live freely in safety with dignity and self-determination, and that is what they are striving for. I don't think that they have necessarily been, from the reporting, the holdup in these negotiations. I believe that should actually be the goal of the U.S. government, though I believe at this point our government is not well positioned to bring about that change unless by the Biden administration and or the possible future Harris administration take considerable pivot in strategy and policy like you were alluding to just before the break. The good news is that if people are interested in learning more, there are more resources than ever. I mean, starting right here on KPFK with programs like Democracy Now!, I'll just shamelessly plug my own show with Negwa Ibrahim on Sundays, Middle East in Focus. There's Radio Intifada, formerly Swana Region Radio. And there's great reporting coming out about this topic on alternative news sites like Drop Zone, The Intercept, Plus 972 Magazine. Mitchell Plitnick has a wonderful Substack blog called Cutting Through. And then, of course, there are books, really important books, like Rashid Khalidi's The 100 Years War on Palestine, Ilan Pape's The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine. Ilan Pape is an Israeli academic. And then Sari McDisi's Palestine Inside Out, and also the McDisi Street podcast that Sari McDisi does along with his brothers Usama and Kareem McDisi, is an excellent source of information.
And of course, so is the website of the Jewish Voice for Peace, and the wonderful, amazing work they've been doing in the very leadership of this wonderful, sadly necessary movement to stop what is going on in Gaza. So to you, S.D. Chandler, thank you so much for the great work you continue to do on this. Thank you for joining us here on the Lawyers Guild Show. We can now move on, can we not, to our next guest, Maria.
Yes, thanks again, SD. Okay, well, traditionally, college campuses have been fertile grounds for free speech and expression. After all, they're places of learning where students can explore ideas and different perspectives. And public schools, of course, are also bound by the First Amendment, which is supposed to protect free speech, even when the content is unpopular or offensive to some. Given the dramatic way the school year ended last year, with mass arrests of students protesting in support of Palestinians, we can't help but wonder how the fall semester will unfold. After all, there's no ceasefire in sight. University of California regents and their officials and other officials have already signaled they will not be tolerating encampments as a form of protest on campus this school year. And to make matters more complex, yesterday, a federal judge here in Los Angeles ordered UCLA to protect the religious freedom of Jewish students on the ground that pro-Palestinian areas were, quote unquote, anti-Semitic. So, again, without a ceasefire on the horizon and the U.S. signaling its continued support of Israel's actions, both on the offense and on the defense, what can we expect going forward on campuses this year? To help us answer these questions, I'm so happy to introduce our guest today, Elizabeth Howell Egan. Elizabeth is a third-year law student at USC's Gould School of Law. She's also an active legal observer and a member of the board of the LA chapter of the National Lawyers Guild. And she's passionate about abolition and community-centered organizing. Elizabeth Howell Egan, welcome to the Lawyers Guild Show.
Hello. Thank you both so much for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Yes. So first, I'm going to go on a little side note. Can you start us off for listeners who aren't really familiar with the Lawyers Guild's legal observing program? Can you just explain its purpose and what you and others do when you're in that role?
Yeah, absolutely. So legal observers are independent third-party volunteers with different chapters of the National Lawyers Guild across the country. And what we do is essentially go out to actions and demonstrations, and we monitor and record police encounters with demonstrators, essentially to document any potential unlawful activity on the part of the police. So if you've been at a protest and maybe seen a few people who wear like these really bright green hats and are writing things down, standing near the cops, that's us. That's legal observers. It's very similar to cop watching, but all of our records that in anything we record at an action are only used in the course of a civil or criminal proceeding. And so organizers can request us at their action as long as it aligns with the guild's values, such as like anti-capitalism, anti-imperialism, things like that.
Now, you know, Elizabeth, the last time you were scheduled to be a guest here on our show was April 24th. And that day, you were, however, legal observing at a protest at USC. And we're only able, therefore, to send us a few updates by text message instead of doing what you're doing now, joining a conversation with us by phone. So remind us, what was the context of those protests at USC at the time? How many students were involved? How did the protests conclude? How did USC handle it? Talk to us about that, because that's what we're going to follow up with for the rest of our interview with you.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I'm glad to not be interrupted by LAPD this time. So yeah, on April 24th, the USC Divest from Death Coalition started its Gaza Solidarity Encampment in Alumni Park, which is a very central area of USC's campus. And the goal of this encampment was to get USC to disclose its financial ties to weapons manufacturers and other warmongering entities, divest from Israeli genocide and settler colonialism, and defend both Palestinians and anti-Zionists on campus and off. Almost immediately, on campus, we were met by our campus police force, which is the Department of Public Safety, or DPS. And throughout the day, DPS escalated, and DPS and administration, they escalated by taking personal property, assaulting students and community members. They even attempted to arrest one community member and USC student and ended up kneeling on his neck for over 20 seconds. They also refused to engage in any meaningful conversations about the coalition's demands. And, meanwhile, while this was all happening at the same time, the coalition was also steadfast in beginning its programming for the Popular University for Gaza, which is a reclamation of our campus to educate and engage students in the fight for divestment in a liberated Palestine. This was really a wonderful showing of students, faculty, staff, alumni, community members coming together in solidarity, refusing to absolutely normalize USC's complicity. But unfortunately, but maybe like not as unexpectedly, admin, including Carol Folt, Errol Southers, Andrew Guzman, and Loretta Hill, decided that they'd rather arrest over 90 people than listen to their students. As of today, no charges have been filed. But on, in addition to that, over 80 students are facing disciplinary action still. Over 30 are still under interim suspension conditions, which means they can't go on campus. They can't get their transcripts. They can't do all sorts of things. And many of the allegations that these students are facing are largely unfounded. The school's really grasping at straws to try and punish community members for standing up for what is right, which is also quite ironic because our school's first unifying value is integrity. But it's quite clear that USC abandons these values when confronted with dissent. That's kind of where we're at now. Both times we set up a camp, or the coalition set up a camp, it was disbanded by the police.
Yeah, excuse me for interrupting, but as perhaps people can tell, maybe not our audience, I can tell, my phone is acting bazooey here. And so I wonder, D'Angelo, if you could call me on the same number. I'm going to hang up this receiver and pick up one when you call me back, where I think the batteries are still alive and we won't get all those annoying buzzes. So, D'Angelo, please just call me back on the same phone number in 10 seconds. I'm going to now hang up my phone while Maria asks the next question, and then I'll be right back with folks.
Sounds good.
Sure. Elizabeth, go ahead. You were saying that, they were grasping at straws on the suspensions and they were not listening to their actual students. Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. And we did have a few meetings with Carol Folt and USC's general counsel to kind of, attempt, to negotiate and at least try and make some sort of step forward in the divestment process. However, USC wasn't even willing to disclose what kind of investments our endowments are based in. There was even a conversation where we're talking about what is a weapons manufacturer and having to deal with these little things that, aren't actually there. It takes away attention and energy from the focus, which should be ending the genocide and ending our complicity in it. And so that was very frustrating, is that it didn't feel like the school was ever really operating in good faith, which is also most like evidently highlighted in the fact that over 90 people were arrested for merely wanting to know where our tuition dollars are going and wanting to stop the genocide. Mm-hmm.
And that is a lot of tuition dollars, I will say, because I also went there.
And they raised it. So. Yeah, I mean, that was a big question. It's that we're paying over 70, paying full tuition, you're paying over 70K to essentially get, arrested and brutalized by this administration that also at the same time turns around and talks about, freedom of speech and how they want everyone to be able to express their opinions. It's very frustrating. But that's mm-hmm. where we're at.
Yes, yeah. And ironic.
And if any of this is duplicative, I apologize. But I wanted to ask you, SD, about one of the more troubling incidents that occurred last spring and how that relates to something that UCLA, our federal judge, has ruled about UCLA. On April 30th of last year, or this last spring at any rate, a group of counter-protesters came onto UCLA's campus. And they started breaking down various barricades, and they started assaulting pro-Palestinian students who had been protesting there. According to the New York Times, many of these counter-protesters were wearing pro-Israeli slogans, and the violence, however, went unchecked. It went unchecked for hours before the campus police or any other policing stepped in to stop this assault on these protesting on behalf of Palestine UCLA students. Has UCLA explained its failure to stop that violence? They were highly criticized for it. Any of the counter-protesters, for example, were they arrested? I mean, we talk about arresting all the pro-Palestinian protesters. And how does all that relate to a federal judge just ordering UCLA to protect the religious freedom of Jewish students on the ground that pro-Palestinian areas are anti-Semitic? I mean, talk to us about that, please.
Yeah, no, absolutely. As far as I know, UCLA, they've made multiple claims about why they failed to stop the violence levied against pro-Palestine demonstrators. And many of them were also then disproven quickly after. For example, I remember a few days after they said that it was an issue with payment, but that's not policy for that. And even looking at how many options and opportunities there were for UCLA to stop this, for example, not giving the event that turned into just violence towards the encampment, not giving them a permit to do that. So they absolutely failed, and they have not, explained it or apologized. I think ultimately as well, there's just no excuse for the way that the school endangered its students. And then also use that violence as a way to then bring in the police and sweep the camp. Immediately after students were traumatized after, multiple nights of just endless attacks, both physical and mental and emotional, dealing with all of this while also being a full-time student, while also dealing with all these other things going on in their lives, you know, UCLA is using, and administration and Gene Block are using this as an excuse to bring in the California Highway Patrol and LAPD and other law enforcement agencies to violently sweep the camp, you know, including firing less lethals more times than some other departments across the country will fire their less lethals an entire year. So it's, you know, absolutely abhorrent and just like the worst, you know, it's very frustrating. I can't, you know, even speaking to some peers at UCLA in particular and talking about that discomfort that I definitely can resonate with of coming back to a school that both enabled and also was like an active participant in the physical harm against you and your friends. And, you know, how do you feel comfortable going back to this place that had such traumatic and horrible memories, essentially? And despite all of that, it's still not as bad as what's going on in Gaza. And it's still something that we are so privileged to be able to be in this space fighting for divestment when there are no universities left in Gaza.
Right. Well, also, they hold so much power, these universities, over our fates. I think,
yeah,
they really have, they should have a higher duty to be protecting the students. I wanted to ask, so we talked already about USC and UCLA, but, you know, I think most of us remember there were a lot of large Palestinian protests all over the country, including, you know, Columbia and New York. And I do understand that, and including the 93 arrests at USC and I don't know how many at UCLA, but all over the country, hundreds and hundreds of students were arrested. Do you have an idea about what kinds of charges were leveled when they were first arrested? And then are authorities actually prosecuting any of those charges, or have charges pretty much been dropped?
Many students, especially on private campuses, are facing trespass charges. And then at public, it can be, you know, unlawful assembly or other kind of protest-related charges, including unlawful assembly. And that's been the most part, as far as I know. We're also seeing some students faced with things like conspiracy charges, which are incredibly concerning, especially as what we see happening in Atlanta with the Stop Cop City folks who are organizing and fighting back against the militarization of their communities. Also seeing that kind of conspiracy charges popping up, and including, you know, schools, I believe Stanford just finally stopped calling for organizers who hadn't been arrested. They were calling for them to be arrested on conspiracy counts, which was incredibly concerning. You know, so it kind of has been a mixed bag, but, you know, also I think not anything too out of pocket, I guess, or too unsurprising. As of today, no students at UCLA or USC have been filed on. However, and this is a tactic that City Attorney Heidi Feltine-Soto does quite often with protest-related arrests, she has not dropped them and she hasn't filed them. So essentially they're just pending. And she does this quite a bit where if it's a protest-related arrest, she'll wait, you know, until the end of the 1-year statute of limitations to file, which is a very deliberate attempt to stifle dissent, to keep people wrapped up in the legal system. And it essentially limits people's organizing, because if you get arrested again in that 1 year, then you have two charges against you. And it's a much easier, you know, it's a much easier thing for her to press rather than just having that one, you know, count of civil disobedience. But unfortunately, also recently in the past few weeks, the district attorney, George Gascon, did file charges against our comrades at Pomona College. They're also facing misdemeanor trespass charges, but they did get filed on, which was quite shocking considering Gascon's, you know, previous policies on protest-related arrests. And so it'll be interesting to see how that plays out and, you know, what actually comes of that. And particularly because it's a misdemeanor trespass, but those are the only students in at least LA County that we're aware of that have been filed on. And I guess also kind of going back to that last question as well, because what we've seen is that there was about one person who was arrested, who was a Zionist attacker of the camp. And I believe Gascon decided not to file. He declined to file charges. And I think it's hard because also, you know, as abolitionists and going into the space, we know that the justice system can't ever bring justice. You know, this like idea of going through the legal system is going to bring justice and accountability. But it is quite staggering to see how, you know, disproportionate these arrests are and the charges are to what's actually going on. And then, you know, of course, always trying to connect this to our other fights, including the folks up in San Francisco who just got charged for their involvement on the Bay Bridge, facing both felonies and misdemeanors and things like that. It definitely is something that we're certainly concerned about as we move into the school year and just generally as we move closer to the election and we continue, you know, continue to support, materially support the genocide in Gaza.
Yeah, we're going to have to let you go and take care of a little business, I guess, in a couple of minutes here. But before we do, I'm wondering, Elizabeth, I'm not sure if you're familiar with this or not, but you're familiar, I'm sure, with what underlies it. The pro-Israel lobby in the United States has been spending huge fortunes, both at the legislative level and at other levels, of making it the case that basically any criticism of Israel is, quote-unquote, somehow deemed to be anti-Semitic, which, of course, is intellectual nonsense. But it's taking some very concrete forms. For example, there's a bill now pending here in California seeking to prevent colleges, high schools, certainly, in California from including in their anti-genocide studies Israel's genocide in Palestine, along with the courses teaching about Germany's genocide of the Jews. I don't know if I say if you're any familiar with that in particular or not, but would you agree that that while there may well be some anti-Semitism in the movement, that it's vastly overestimated to a truly dishonest degree?
Yeah, absolutely. I think maybe Esty can also speak to this, but this is something we really focused on as well at our encampment and generally, especially because, you know, trying to break down these conceptions and understandings of what anti-Zionism is and what Zionism is as an ideology, things of that nature, and really trying to push back on the idea and that conflation of anti-Zionism with anti-Semitism. And I think a lot of that comes with building community and really bringing people into the movement and also having them understand why we're here, what we're fighting for, and how it is not anti-Semitic to say free Palestine or from the river to the sea, things of that nature. And I think it's really dangerous to continue to conflate that. And especially, you know, we recently had our JVP chapter start up here at USC, and that's something that, you know, our JVP chapter is really, you know, looking forward to being able to continue to work at, because it's also, you know, a form of erasure of anti-Zionist Jews. And yeah, there's it's incredibly problematic in so many different ways. And it's also, you know, something that we really can take advantage of at the university level in terms of actually pushing back and bringing folks in and using political education to really break down what these, you know, ideas mean and how we can engage with them in a critical way.
All right.
Esty, if you have anything you want to add, please do.
Well, yeah, just interrupting only because we do have to do a little business, as much as I'd rather talk with you, and no doubt our listeners might feel the same way, but I want them to stay tuned because we have something important to say to them about that. Maria, why don't you thank our guest? And, by the way, you might want to tell us, Elizabeth, though, where people can learn more about the National Lawyers Guild Legal Observing Program. It's like, you don't have to be a lawyer or a law student to be a part of it. So tell them how they could get in touch with that, too.
Yeah, absolutely. You can visit our website. It's nlg.org/loss-angeles. You can also follow us on social media. We're active on Instagram and Twitter. On Instagram, it's at nlg.la. And you can also email us if you want to learn more about the program at locoordinator@nlg-la.org. We host monthly LO trainings. Yeah, anyone can come. We actually really encourage folks to come who are not lawyers or law students. We have a really great community, and there's always a need. We'll post those trainings. We email them out about a couple weeks in advance, and we also post them about a couple weeks in advance. So we look forward to it.
Thank you.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much to both of you. Do you have 15 seconds, Esty, to give your two cents on that?
Sure. I mean, the pro-Israel lobby is trying to sell Israel as a democracy. So Jim was alluding to California Senate Bill 1277, 1277, that is being pushed forward by Israel lobby groups. It is an attempt to make sure that genocide education in California is largely directed by something called the California Teachers Collaborative, which is a group made up of mostly entirely pro-Israel organizations, including the ever controversial and historically racist ADL. You can find more about that and three other bills, another one in the Senate and another one, two in the State Assembly, SB 1287, AB 2918, and AB 2925. All of them are highly problematic and being pushed by the Israel lobby.
Thank you so much, Chandler.
Well, thank you both. Thank you both. And now, don't we have to do a little business, Maria?
Yes. Can you hear me, Jim?
Yes, loud and clear.
Yes. All right. Yes. Thank you. Yes, unfortunately, we are just about out of time, but we did want to remind listeners that it is KPFK's Fund Drive time. And nowhere else can you hear frank discussions like you get here. These are candid discussions. These are difficult, challenging discussions. These are, you know, it's not just all, you know, the corporate way or the highway. This is a different road. Sometimes we have to blaze it ourselves, and we are trying to become a better human society. And KPFK is all about that message. So please do give kpfk.org. You can go there and put in your donation, or give us a call at 818-985-5735. I don't know if free speech has ever been this at risk because of our Supreme Court. So we need to keep on funding KPFK. It's not funded by taxpayers, and it's not funded by corporations. It's funded by you and me. So we have the power.
Yeah, indeed. And I think this shows an example of when I say that one reason I would hope people would support it, if you support the kind of programming you hear on KPFK regularly, the Lawyers Guild Show and others, we're really part of a progressive movement here, a humanist movement, if you will. We're not corporate media. We bring on guests who are from the various movements that impact life in this country today, and who have their story to tell and don't get a chance to tell it anywhere else. And I can bet you, because we know what happens, that as a result of today's show, for example, there will be some people who will go to the Jewish Voice for Peace website and decide they want to join that organization. There'll be people who just heard Elizabeth talking about the necessity and excitement of being part of the Lawyers Guild's Legal Observing Program who will go to the website and decide they want to be trained to become a legal observer. So we really are the support voice, if you will, of the humanist, progressive movement here, alternative news, you know, movement here in Los Angeles. That's why we think you should support us. We're never going to have the kind of money that CNN has or anybody else has, but by George, we want to stay on the air and still keep bringing you the kind of programming that, if you're listening now, you obviously appreciate. Therefore, we want you to give us a call at 818-985-5735. And, as Maria said, though, easy, just go to the website. Lots of ways there. We say thank you when you do contribute. Contribute whatever amount you feel you can afford. Every contribution, new membership is heralded and loved and appreciated by all of us here at KPFK. So please do that, my friends. Keep us alive and functioning well, and our employees earning a decent living and all the rest. Right, Maria?
Absolutely. Yes.
I think I hear some music playing, do I? Yeah, I'm afraid so. Well, that's it for this week then, my friends. You've been listening to the Lawyers Guild Show. I'm Jim Lafferty, along with Maria Hall and our wonderful engineer, D'Angelo Jones. But we're going to have to be saying goodbye for now. Please do support us during this fun drive. And be sure to stay healthy. Stay active, stand up for your rights, and join us again next week at the same time and place.
Stand up for your rights. Come on, get up, stand up.
Please help keep independent journalism alive and KPFK Radio strong. Become a Sustainer Circle member of KPFK by pledging at any level. $10, $20, $100 per month, whatever suits you.
This is Verdeen White of Earth, Wind, and Fire, encouraging you to make your tax-deductible donation today at 818-985-5735 or kpfk.org.
When we say this is listener-supported free speech radio, what are we really saying? The free speech radio part is about thought-provoking, challenging programming that uncovers stories you wouldn't normally hear on the radio. Listener-supported means it's your money that pays for these programs, and the transmitters, the computers, the electricity, everything it takes to bring you this service. So here's a very big thank you to you, the listener, in listener-supported free